Merry Christmas, happy holidays, and season's greetings. You are listening to the 12 Questions of Christmas, a holiday special brought to you out of the studios at Washington and Lee University and your NPR station WMRA. I am Stephen Lind, a business communication professor at Washington and Lee and the author of the newly released Peanuts comic strip biography, A Charlie Brown Religion, exploring the spiritual life and work of Charles M. Schulz. And I am joined by Washington and Lee marketing professor Amanda Bauer. You can find her witty insights on social media by following at HeyProfBow, that's B-O-W. Welcome, Amanda. Thanks for joining to talk all things Christmas.
I am very happy to be here. I'm very happy to talk Christmas as well.
All 12 questions of the Christmas.
Oh, well, we might just get to 8 maids of milking, but we'll see how this turns out. Yeah.
As long as we get to 5 golden rings, we'll all be happy.
Right, right.
So Amanda and I will be answering the 12 burning questions about this holiday season. Should you say happy holidays or Merry Christmas? What's up with lying to kids about Santa Claus? And what does the Supreme Court have to say about putting up nativity displays? So get your extra cup of cocoa or eggnog now because you won't want to change that dial. But before we get into that first question, Amanda, what is Christmas like for you these days?
Well, it's somewhat different than it was 30 years ago. I have two kids who have sort of worked their way out of the Mattel phase of life and are currently in, I would say, pretty solidly in a Lego era of the world, except my son is pretty much, I guess, out of the Lego era and would be perfectly content if I got him 10 different iTunes cards and wrapped them in 10 different boxes of varying size with bricks in there to hide what the actual content would be. He would be completely fine with that.
A little surprise for the season.
This one has 3 bricks, which is kind of
as long as it has the iTunes card.
As long as it has the iTunes card, yeah. So it's pretty busy, and of course, being a college professor makes it even busier because our grades are due 2 days from now. It's a pretty busy week for me. So how's Christmas for you these days?
It's good for me. To be honest, the book has taken up a good chunk of my Christmas life, which I won't lie, I'm loving, totally loving.
Yeah.
Christmas is a wonderful time to talk about Charlie Brown, but I have real strong Midwestern roots. I'm from Michigan, the snowy north, and so I've kind of grown up loving the Christmas season, loving the lights and the sounds and just the whole whole enchilada.
Right, right.
So I'm really
happy. Are enchiladas
happy.
From up there, or are they, you know,
no,
somewhere
I suppose,
further south?
I wonder, is there a festive version of an enchilada? I don't know. Maybe Feliz Navidad has a missing verse that we don't know about.
Right.
I don't know. Let's get into these questions, though. 12 of them. Let's see. Where do we start? The first question we have, question number one, really, I guess, asks the question that people have been asking for probably more than a month now, and that is, how early really is too early to start Christmas? Maybe how early is too early to start shopping for Christmas?
Okay, well, so I'm in marketing, and so that is, you know, that's my domain. What are we doing in marketing, and how much money should you spend, and when should you start spending it, that kind of stuff. And so I'm going to start answering your question by asking you a little pop quiz, I guess.
Uh-oh.
Okay, so thinking about 4 different categories of people, fathers, mothers, men without children, and women without children. And by without children, I mean people, no children at home under the age of 18. So,
I'm
reproduced
with you.
And you have a 30-year-old, that doesn't count. Mm-hmm. So fathers, mothers, men without children, women without children, who do you think is most likely to shop on Black Friday?
Oh, interesting. Let's see. So I actually did a book signing on Black Friday, and I saw a good number of folks.
Now in stores.
Not coming by to sign the book, but just stopping in front of the table to convalesce because they had been going all day long.
Yeah.
And I think that the most of them that I saw were looked like mothers.
Okay.
But this is my unscientific analysis.
Right, right. Okay. So the answer is actually fathers.
No kidding.
Yeah. By a mile. If by a mile, I mean 17 percentage points.
Yeah.
Yeah. So fathers. So 51% of fathers plan on shopping during Black Friday.
Really?
Yeah. 34% of mothers plan on shopping during Black Friday, and then it drops off precipitously. So if you don't have children and you're a woman, you are hiding at home with, like, I don't know, a cocoa and, say, a good book, possibly, written by Stephen J. Lynn.
Right. Count those shameless plugs, folks.
I know. Yeah. I know. 10% of women who don't have children don't have any plans on going out on Black Friday. And so the answer to the question of how early is too early to start shopping for Christmas really depends on whether you're a parent or not.
Wow.
So it depends on whether you're a parent. It depends on the number of children that you have, and as well as the age of the children that you have. It's actually really pretty interesting. If you look at so to be fair, the men, the fathers who are shopping really hardcore at Christmas time on Black Friday are not really particularly shopping heavily before Black Friday, nor are they shopping very heavily after Black Friday. But if you don't have children, 47% of people plan on shopping, starting their Christmas shopping before Thanksgiving. If
really?
You have one child, that goes up to 53%.
Wow.
If you have two children, it goes up to 54%, a little bit. If you have three children, the wheels fall off the thing, and it goes up to 67%. 67% of people with three children or more start shopping for Christmas before Thanksgiving, which I think one of the major reasons for this is because the more children that you have, it does seem that it turns Christmas less into this wonderful festive event, you know, the stuff that Linus talks about, and more into like a D-Day invasion kind of strategic plan where you're having to, I have to get the Christmas tree up, and I have to get to these wraps, and I have to get the things for my parents because my parents don't want anything, but they still want something from me. And so I think it turns into more of an effort, more of a thing that you have to plan and do. So it also goes to age as well. If you have a child under the age of five, 60% of people start shopping for Christmas before Thanksgiving. And by the time the kid is 18 years old, it goes down to 48%. So it really is about the kids and how much effort is involved in sort of getting the infrastructure, I guess you could think of it as, you know, the materials of Christmas together before you can, you know, really start to get into feeling what Christmas is like.
Interesting. This actually leads us into our question number two, which is, how early is too early for Christmas music or for Christmas TV shows? Is that different than the shopping season?
I think it is, you know, and I think we don't really separate those two things.
Mm-hmm.
I think a lot of times when we think about Christmas, so there's always somebody in June who puts something on Facebook that says, there are only 150 more shopping days until Christmas. And, you know, and the comments that follow that are never, yay! Mm-hmm. You know, they're always, oh my gosh, I can't believe, now I'm really stressed out. You know, but of course, they're not really thinking about the feeling stuff. They're not thinking, what do you mean I only have 150 more days before I can, you know, be kind to my fellow man and really think about the meaning of Christmas? It's more, you know, oh my gosh, I have to find coupons and go to Toys R Us. So I think there are two different things. I think there's the doing of Christmas. You know, there's the infrastructure and the putting up the tree and the buying the tree and paying the credit cards. I think that's the doing. But I think the feeling of Christmas, you know, if you're having a bad day and it's July and you need to go home and have a cup of hot cocoa and you need to listen to, you know, I'm Dreaming of a White Christmas, get on in there and get your feet wet. But I do think the idea of having that, I mean, personally, I think the idea of having that holiday be sort of self-contained and special, you know, as opposed to sort of dragging it out through all the whole year, I think that's kind of a, I think that makes it more special.
Yeah, it makes it almost a little more potent when you only get it in certain doses as opposed to maybe the whole year.
Yeah, you don't want a homeopathic Christmas.
Right,
yeah.
Right. Though, truth be told, I do listen to Christmas music on occasion throughout the whole year, but maybe I'm one of the outliers. Though, at the same time, television networks are moving their Christmas programming up earlier and earlier each year.
Right.
Part of that is due to sometimes just where the calendar falls.
Right.
This year, for instance, A Charlie Brown Christmas airs on television twice. The first time was actually on November 30th, which is earlier. It's actually,
right.
I mean, so we have a Christmas show on TV in November, which some of the folks on Twitter were quite upset about. But that's partially just due to the Advent calendar.
Yeah.
Advent, the first Sunday of Advent started in November on the 29th. And so the 30th was part of this Advent season. It's also for television executives, though, it is increasingly difficult to program Christmas time. It is it's mayhem to try to fit all of the programs in.
Yeah.
It is perhaps the only time of the year when you have such large numbers of viewers who want both new content and old content.
Right, right.
A Charlie Brown Christmas is 50 years old this year. Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer, the special, is 51 years old. So we have over half a century worth of TV shows that we want back on the air. Plus, you want all your new stuff. You want your Lady Gaga, Tony Bennett special.
We don't really want that. We're okay with that one.
Maybe some new Mariah Carey, Carrie Underwood. I'm not really sure. But viewers want both new and old, and there's limited space. And some of that space is taken up by holiday parties, too. So television programming executives know that certain Saturday nights, which are usually low ratings anyway, are almost totally taken off the table because of holiday schedules during the season. And so it puts pressure on them to make their holidays season on television or the radio start earlier and earlier so that people can get in as much as they want.
Right, yeah. Well, and it's an interesting question as well. We just spent, my family, we were in the UK over Thanksgiving break. And of course, the UK has no Thanksgiving speed bump to slow anybody down from having Christmas. So we get there and it's already decorated for Christmas and the skating rinks are out and the Christmas trees are up and the streets are all decorated. And of course, they also have a Black Friday, which is absolutely bizarre because they're sort of missing the horse to that cart. There is no Thanksgiving. but it's, it does seem that there needs to be some containment of Christmas to sort of, you know, like you said, make it more potent and make it more unique and special as opposed to sort of, you know, dangled out throughout the course of the year.
Yeah. Speaking of shopping, we have question number three up on deck for us, and that is, what is up with gift cards, marketing professor Amanda Bauer? What is up with gift cards? Do they actually make a good present?
Okay. Well, that's a good question because, nothing says, hi, I remembered you vaguely, quite like a holiday gift card. I'm not really clear what you wanted. Here, have this. But what's interesting is when you look at the numbers, so 89% of people this year are planning on buying a gift card. And 87% of people actually want one.
Wow.
Yeah, I know. And I thought that's insane. But of course, I think we're probably missing the specificity, you know, from where do I want this gift card, that kind of stuff. But the question is it a good present? So people want it. People are planning on giving it. But, you know, the numbers vary depending on the year that you're looking at, but it looks to be about between 20 and 25-ish percent of gift cards go completely unredeemed.
Wow.
So the most recent number that I could find was in 2014. It was reported that over $44 billion worth of gift cards were unclaimed since 2008.
Wow.
I know. That is, and think about what a gift card is. Hi, here have $25. Yeah. And don't do anything with it until somebody else shows back up. And it just sits there.
We're just walking into the stores donating money.
Yeah.
Just donating money to the stores. Here at Bed Bath & Beyond, here's $25.
Have $25. Merry Christmas.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, but the next question is, the Consumer Reports went off and looked and they said, well, why aren't people using gift cards? And so 35% of people said, well, it's coming from a store I didn't want to go to. I don't want, I'm not interested in, I don't like Bed Bath & Beyond, I don't like beds, I don't like baths and whatever, you know, I'm not a big Star Trek fan or something.
Beyond is too much to
explore. Beyond is just, it's just way over my head. 58% of people said because they don't have the time.
Oh.
So, but that's an interesting question. You don't have time to spend money. You had time to do shopping. You were the 89% of people who went off and bought a gift card. But we don't have time. So here's what I think is so interesting about this idea about we don't have time. So there was some research that was done by some marketing academics, and we exist, out in California. And they did some research, and they found out that a major reason why people don't redeem gift cards is because they are procrastinating. But it doesn't make any sense, right? You procrastinate on things you don't want to do. You procrastinate on the laundry or doing your homework or unloading the dishwasher. But what's interesting about gift cards is redeeming a gift card takes effort. So if I get a gift card to a spa, I have to clear my schedule. I have to figure out when it's going to be. I have the opportunity cost of, you know, I'm not doing the laundry that I should be doing. So there's effort involved in redeeming a gift card. I have to go to Bed Bath & Beyond and wade myself through there and figure out what is it that I want to do. And so there are inherent costs. And what's interesting is psychologists have found that if we think about the costs, the negativity of the things that we have to do now, we weigh that much more heavily. We sort of see that much more negatively than costs that we have beyond, sometime in the future, sometime way off. So we think those costs later on won't be that big, but the costs we have now are really substantial. So what we're trying to do is we're trying to maximize the ratio between the benefit I get out of this card and the costs, you know, the non-monetary costs required in redeeming this card. And so we end up putting it off. We end up saying, well, I'll get that facial later. And then later comes, and now it's now, and now the costs are now. And so I put it off until later again. So we procrastinate. And what's interesting about this is the way to stop the procrastination is to put a deadline on it, to have an expiration date, which we think is horrific. We think, oh my gosh, putting an expiry. I gave you $25. Now that $25 is going to expire.
It comes with strings attached.
Yes. What are you kidding me with this? So if you actually put an expiration date on it, it actually has the effect of causing people to redeem more frequently. So these researchers did this research where they gave people gift certificates to a French cafe. And the group of people who got 3 weeks, it expired in 3 weeks, of those, 31% were redeemed. Of those people who had the gift certificate expired in 2 months, only 6% redeemed it.
Wow.
Yeah, so significant drop. Other people got gift certificates or a gift card to go to the movies. Some, if they had a two-week expiration date, 49% of the people used their gift card. If they had a six-week expiration date, only 35% of people use the gift card. So just saying, I will use it by this time, will, you know, keep you from having what I have, which is a pile of Target cards sitting in some drawer somewhere, which is ridiculous because it's not like I can't make time for, Target, right? I have time for Target, but those cards are just sitting there because I'm trying to maximize, you know, enjoyment of the gift card with what's going to be involved in actually spending it and using it, the cognitive energy.
Wow. Fascinating. We are only three questions in, and already this holiday is more complex than we might have thought. When we come back, Amanda Bauer and I will chat with some special guests about decorating aluminum Christmas trees and breaking the news that Santa is not real. We are talking seasonal surprises on this holiday special, The 12 Questions of Christmas. I am Stephen Lind, author of A Charlie Brown Religion, and I am here with Washington and Lee marketing professor Amanda Bauer.
Okay, so I have a question for you as a marketing professor. One of the challenges that's facing retailers this time every year, what do we say to our consumers or to our customers? Do we say, Merry Christmas, but that's, you know, very focused. But there's a group of people who really want to hear that. Or do we say Happy Holidays, which is more inclusive? And of course, when I was a kid, I always thought Happy Holidays meant, you know, Christmas and New Year's Eve, or maybe even Thanksgiving. My brother thought it was referring to his birthday, which is the day after Christmas.
Lucky him.
Yeah. I know. Well, he would debate that. But so what are your thoughts on, you know, which should we say? Should we say Merry Christmas? Should we say Happy Holidays? What are you thinking?
This often comes up each year as a sort of what's been labeled the war on Christmas. And sometimes, truth be told, that gets a little bit trumped up a little bit, perhaps, a little bit sensationalized in ways that maybe doesn't need to be. Though at the same time, there is a real history in American culture of mainstream industries being wary of being specific about the religious history of Christmas. Even back in the 1960s, when A Charlie Brown Christmas was aired on television for the first time, television executives were scared that having Linus quote from the Bible on television was going to offend some viewers. And he simply quoted directly from the King James Bible about about the birth of Christ. It wasn't like he was making any sort of theological dogma statement one way or another. But less than 9%, even in the 1960s, less than 9% 10% of television shows had a substantive reference to religion. So this is not a new phenomenon that American culture is dealing with. How specific should we be or shouldn't we be? The real question is partially intention and partially perception. So if a store is meaning to be more inclusive by saying happy holidays, that is... That's a good thing. Inclusion is something that I think most in our society would ascribe to.
Right.
If the intention is to exclude the religious history of Christmas.
Oh, right.
That one gets a little more trickier.
Right.
And it's actually a little bit, perhaps even impossible to do. Even when you say happy holidays.
Right.
Etymologically, holidays comes from the Old English Heilig Days, which means holy day. So if you're saying happy holidays, you are saying happy holy days.
You're being
so
sneaky.
good luck being secular there.
Right.
And so the intention is perhaps a question. The perception is another question, though. So
right.
For businesses considering saying happy holidays versus Merry Christmas, they're probably not going to gain much traction. There is the possibility that they may get a vocal minority who are upset that they are not saying Merry Christmas. Most consumers are okay with either. It's the vocal minority that sensationalizes this so-called war on Christmas.
Right. And what is the story behind Xmas?
So Xmas is another one where perceptions really are perhaps 90% of the game.
Uh-huh.
Xmas is a term that is often, Christian communities cry foul about Xmas for being a blatant attempt to secularize Christmas and take out Christ and just put an X there. And that is a real perception that is valid. Historically, though, it's actually quite backwards.
I thought the X was the cross.
The X is actually a stand-in for the Greek letter chi, which is the first letter in Christos, or Christ.
Okay.
So the X for centuries, actually, has been used to stand in as kind of an ornate and shortened version of Christ. We actually still see this at times. When someone writes the name Christina, for instance, they might write X-tina, but we still say Christina.
Right.
And so historically, Xmas originally meant Christmas, but again, perception is 9/10 of the game, and so if you're offending folks with Xmas, you might just want to strategically rethink that approach.
Okay, well, that's pretty interesting. I did not know that. I always had thought that it was the cross turned sideways, or it was, I don't know, LOL speak or something.
Anyway. Yeah.
So speaking about the idea of the secularization of Christmas, what is the origin of Santa Claus?
So very similar to Xmas, Santa Claus stands in for many communities as being the symbol of secularized Christmas, that we no longer have the baby in the manger. Instead, we have Santa Claus in his sleigh. Historically, actually, Santa Claus comes from Saint Nicholas, who was a real saint in what is now modern-day Turkey in the 4th century. He was a real saint who was known for giving gifts to individuals. He was known for having performed a number of miracles, like most of the saints. And his story developed a certain legend around it over the years. And through a handful of cultural transmogrifications, such as moving up into some communities up in Northern Europe where we had the Dutch Sinterklaas for Saint Nicholas. It's just a shortened version of that form. We then have some Dutch settlers coming over to the Americas, taking their Sinterklaas traditions. And then as it grows through the years of Americans pushing back against Christmas and then post-Civil War, loving Christmas again, we now have the play or the poem written that we know as 'Twas the Night Before Christmas, in which St. Nicholas is described again as a ruddy old elf, and we, over the course of over 1,000 years, have gone from St. Nicholas to Sinterklaas to a ruddy old elf that turned into something that we see now as jolly old St. Nicholas, our Santa Claus.
And now we put him on Coke cans.
right. He turns all chubby and cheery, and we give him Rudolph, that ninth reindeer.
Right.
And he goes from being a venerated saint to a plastic wall decor.
There's nothing wrong with that.
Maybe not.
Some of my best friends are plastic wall decor.
Well, speaking of all things plastic and Santa Claus, now seems like a great time to extend a Merry Christmas and a Happy Holiday, season's greetings and all the like, to our other guest in the studio, Professor Megan Fulcher. Megan is a psychology professor at Washington and Lee University who has done some innovative and very interesting research on child psychology, which leads us to our next question. When is the best time to tell a child that Santa Santa Claus is not real. Welcome, Megan, and we are quite curious about your insights.
Thank you very much. Thank you. I think that it's an interesting question because when you listen to people talk about their Christmases, they'll tell you everyone has a story of when they learned about Santa Claus. Mm-hmm. But I do have to say, as a developmental psychologist and an expert, that I haven't really heard anybody say that when they learned about it is when they turned to a life of crime or anything. Mm. So it doesn't seem to be the gateway to a family tragedy. And it's interesting that you say, when is the best time for parents to tell kids about this? Because the stories I've heard, parents don't have a lot of choice in the matter a lot of the times. And I think that's really developmentally the best way to do it, is to let it unfold kind of naturally and let the kid lead the way. Mm-hmm. And so a lot of times when kids start asking questions, parents can get closer and closer to the answer and start to make sure the kid really is ready to know. And so say things like, well, tell me what you think. And the kid might just come out and spill the beans that they figured it all out.
Okay, good. I'm handling this correctly. Because yeah. I'm getting these questions. Do you think Santa Claus is real? What do you think, child?
And then as they are getting closer and closer, I think give them a little padding to process it. So say things like, well, if it wasn't true, how would that make you feel? And so mm-hmm. they might go away at that time and be quiet for a couple of days and then come back more ready to mm-hmm. talk about it.
Right.
So I think that that's the way to do it, is to let them figure it out on their own and ask questions. If they ask you and they ask you to tell the truth, you should do it. I apparently am just a really bad Santa Claus, and both of my kids caught me.
Oh, sneaking down with the toys?
Yes.
Oh,
well,
no.
But right at the right time. Is probably a problem. Yeah.
Yes.
Go back to bed.
Caught on. It's lunchtime.
Well, speaking of toys, while you're here, another question for you.
Okay.
What are the best toys for young boys or young girls? Is there a such thing as a best toy for a boy or girl? How can we know?
No, and I think that that's important to underline for parents and even grandparents, is when you're shopping for a toy, if you want a toy that promotes a certain skill or gets a kid who has certain interests, to just look at that toy for the toy itself and not to think about the gender of the kid. We do this kind of research in my lab. We're looking particularly at toys that are designed to interest girls in STEM and science and math. And what a lot of companies have done, probably with good intentions, was to sort of pink wash everything and to make these toys more pink than they were originally.
They did that with some Legos, right?
You
had a pink
did.
Lego set.
Mm-hmm. So Legos is a really good example of a company that had been taking some pushback about their sets getting more and more masculine and kind of blocking girls out of the toy. And what we see is in this Lego Friends, those sets, when you buy the pink set, they're a lot less complicated to make. So they have less pieces. The pieces are bigger, and so it's not as sophisticated. And then even at the end, after you built the thing, you have this Lego thing. And for girls, those sets are very different than they are for boys. And so you end up with a feminine toy to play with, a salon or a smoothie shop or a mall are the kinds of things you can make with Lego Friends. And so we worry about that essentially, if what you're doing is trying to interest girls in science, you're just getting them another mall or doll kit. We also worry a little bit because research has shown that if you feminize something, especially something that is going to promote masculine skills like STEM stuff. So there's been a lot of research with Barbie. And so can Barbie promote STEM? And they get girls playing with Barbies in these non-traditional outfits. Mm. And they get them to think about, oh, Barbie can be a scientist. Barbie can work in the laboratory. And so the girls go through this whole thing, and then they ask the girls, do you want to play with some science stuff or do you want to play with Barbie stuff? Mm-hmm. And they want to play with Barbie stuff. And so it seems like playing with highly feminized toys that's supposed to attract them more to this STEM skills is really just another way to get them to play with
almost
Barbie.
Ghettoized, almost.
Right.
Yeah. I've heard it's called the Smurfette problem. Where it's you have this all the Smurfs, and then you have the one girl who's
right.
the Smurfette. Mm-hmm. So it's this sort of marginalized thing, yeah.
So if there is a girl that is interested in science and technology, what maybe are some suggestions for how to explore what to buy that sort of child?
Okay. So I would just let go of the idea that it's a boy or a girl mm-hmm. and think about stuff like that. So basic Lego bricks are really good. If you're not building a set, there's a lot of cognitive skills that kids build when they're playing with Legos. There are science kits where you make all kinds of things or learn about levers or simple machines, or there's chemistry sets, as long as they're not like making makeup or perfume, which a lot of science kits do for girls, which kind of reminds girls that there is a science you can do, but it's this kind of science. Mm. And what we see is it also blocks out lots of girls who are interested in science, but not perfume and makeup. And we don't want to put down those kind of girls and their interest in science.
Fascinating. Well, thank you so much, Megan Fulcher, a psychology professor at Washington and Lee, for joining us. You have given us some good insights, and for those still doing a little bit of shopping, you have a little bit of time left to go get your presents that are maybe a little bit less pink and blue oriented and a little bit more content oriented.
Yes.
Fantastic. All right, that brings us up to question number 8 then. What do we have for question number 8?
Well, the question I have for you is, which do you think is better, an artificial Christmas tree or chopping? This is a terrible question. You wrote this question. Or chopping down a live tree?
Well, I mean,
rescuing a tree from the forest.
Someone's got to chop it down or saw it down with your little wooden hacksaw. This is an interesting question. There have actually, since the 1800s, there has been an artificial tree industry. There were goose down feather trees that folks would use because there were concerns that poor tree harvesting practices were actually doing harm to the forests. Mm-hmm. And so feathers were used to make these really beautiful trees. The problem with those trees, though, is that they can't hold anything. You can't put an ornament on a goose feather. And so in the 1950s, then, we had a real boom in the American industry with artificial trees when a toilet brush company actually out of, I think it was Chicago, the Addis Brush Company, took one of their toilet brush patents and patented it in order to make an aluminum Christmas tree.
I stand by the real tree.
Yeah.
Right there.
Yeah. I know. Yeah, once you know that your aluminum tree might have a history in a toilet brush, well, it might change your perception of the season. But so in the mid-century, then, there was a big flourish and then a big letdown as we kind of had a Victorian resurgence. And over the last 50 years, it's kind of mellowed out a little bit, partially because we have some really beautiful artificial trees now that really kind of have the warmth of a real tree without needing either the care or maybe the environmental concerns of a possible using a real tree.
Right.
We also have the special treat of having a guest on the line who can add some further insights about all things Christmas trees and decorations. Wayne Bronner is the CEO of Bronner's Christmas Wonderland, the largest Christmas store in the world, located in Frankenmuth, Michigan, my home state of Michigan. Welcome to the program, Mr. Bronner.
Hey, it's an honor to be here. Merry Christmas to all your listeners.
I guess my first question is, can you tell our listeners a little bit about Bronner's history?
Oh, that goes back a long ways. My father came from a family of Masons. They came over from Germany. Now, not Masons in the sense of the affiliation, but Masons in the sense of builders. So they were stone workers. They actually built most of the structures in Frankenmuth here. So my grandfather assumed that young Wally, my dad, would follow in his footsteps there and become a Mason also. Well, Wally was of the inclination that he wanted to be an artist. So he started a sign painting business, and he also decorated windows. One time he was trimming some windows in Bay City, Michigan, which is at the crook there. Michigan is like a hand, and it's basically at the web of the hand. And the merchants, there was owners of a hardware store, I should say, they were inquired upon by some people from the village of Clare whether or not they sold some Christmas decorations. And they said, no, we don't sell anything like that, but why don't you talk to that young window trimmer out there? That was my father, Wally, at the age of 18. So he painted them some Christmas panels, Village of Clare, and they hung them from their lampposts in the street. And they were so well received, and there was such a overwhelming justification and ramification of the Christmas displays that they were inquired upon by many other people in many other villages. And they put two and two together and basically said, hey, there's something here. There's a tremendous demand for Christmas decorations. So they started to branch out into the Christmas decorations end of thing, did a little survey. They rented a schoolhouse, and people, Frankenmuth is a pretty conservative German town here, So people thought Wally was a little bit off when he stuffed an old schoolhouse full of Christmas decorations, but there was just a fantastic turnout. He invited people from all over the state to come, and there was just a tremendous response to it. So that proved that there was a demand for Christmas decorations, and that was really the origin of the world's largest Christmas store. That's how we got on the Christmas tangent, and it just kept growing from there.
Wow. Why do you think it is that people love Christmas decorations so much?
Oh, I think Christmas is a wonderful time of year. It elicits so many emotions and so forth. There's really nothing negative associated with Christmas. It's all about friends and family and love and caring and the birth of Jesus Christ, the most wonderful gift. So it's just a fantastic time of year, and everybody has positive associations with Christmas decorations, and Frankenmuth is one of the places that you're going to find the world's largest assortment of Christmas decor.
Now, how large is your store? It is really quite expansive. I've been there a number of times, but tell our listeners just how big the store is we're thinking about.
To put it in perspective, we're about 320,000 square feet. So if you're more of the agricultural end of it and think in terms of acres, it's about 8 acres in size. If you are a football player and you think of football fields, it's about 5.5 football fields.
Wow.
So it's a big facility.
All full of Christmas decorations.
Wow.
50,000 gifts and trims, and the good news is that 2/3 of them retail for less than $20, so things are very, very affordable.
I have a question for you. I've actually ordered from Bronner's quite a bit. Half my tree is full of stuff from your store. What is your most popular Christmas decoration?
That's interesting. Probably the single most popular item would be a red 4-inch ball. And it's just a traditional, classic Christmas ornament that's been around for years and years and years. And my father actually started the tradition of painting names on there. So since that time, we've painted hundreds and hundreds of thousands of names on these red, shiny Christmas ornaments. And, of course, we have them in a variety of colors now, but red still is the number one seller.
That's fascinating.
It's both classic and personalized.
Yeah.
How wonderful. Now, we have one more question for you before we let you go. What do you think about the age-old debate, or maybe a half-a-century-old debate, about live-cut Christmas trees versus artificial Christmas trees?
Now, that's an interesting one. And we've noticed a growing trend. Many, many more people now are coming in inquiring about the artificial Christmas trees, and they'll tell us stories about how they've had a real Christmas tree, and maybe it's time to make the switch to an artificial Christmas tree, do the inquiries, and actually they make the artificial Christmas trees look so real now that they are very, very close in as far as a look, and you can even get a spray scent that makes them smell just like the real trees. So some people they are dyed in the wool and like the traditional Christmas trees, the fact that they're going to go out and cut their own and so forth or buy it from a lot, bring it in. It's all a matter of personal preference, and other people prefer the convenience and the ease of putting up an artificial Christmas tree that's going to be good for several years.
And I guess logistically, many of your trees I know come pre-lit, and so you don't have to deal with that tangle of light string.
That is true. They even make trees now. There's the age-old debate, do we put on clear lights or do we put on multicolored lights? Well, now in the era of LEDs, the manufacturers have switches, so you can switch it from clear to LED just by hitting a remote control button.
No kidding. Mood lighting with your Christmas tree. Who'd have guessed? Well, guys, welcome to 2015.
We don't have flying cars, but yeah. We can change the color of our Christmas tree.
Yeah, we have our priorities straight.
Yeah.
Well, thank you so much, Mr. Wayne Bronner, for joining us. You can find out more about this beautiful store at www.bronners.com. Thank you so much for being with us.
Been my pleasure.
Thank you so much.
All right, we are 3/4 of the way there. When we return, we will get to perhaps the heart of the holiday and talk about its religious origins. We're back to your holiday special, the 12 Questions of Christmas, where we answer those lingering and burning questions you've had about this holiday season. We have already discussed Santa, so let's get to what Linus described as what Christmas is all about, Charlie Brown. the celebration of the birth of Christ. We just have three questions left. Maybe four. Four questions left.
Four. Okay. So my question to you is, when did the church start celebrating Christmas?
Mm.
And why is it on December 25th? Is that actually what Jesus's, you know, passport would be stamped?
Yeah.
December the 25th? So why is
that?
His
birth certificate reads. So Christmas has been celebrated since about the 300s, so like the 4th century AD. And there is some historical debate as to the actual specific first date, but the first recorded date we have is in AD 336. There was simply a note in a journal that referenced celebrating the birth of Christ on December 25th, so the 4th century. So we've been doing this as a people for a very long time now. But whether or not December 25th is the date that Jesus was born on is something that church historians, for the most part, throw their hands up in the air and say, we can't know for sure. That was historically 2,000 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
And I will make the point, too, that while there is lots of different opinions about the role of Jesus theologically or supernaturally, mm-hmm. was he really God incarnate? Was he a good prophet? Was he someone that we don't need to care about at all? There's mm-hmm. a lot of different opinions on that. Most historians, though, do agree that a historical person named Jesus really did exist. There's enough histories to say that, yeah, this guy probably was a real guy.
Right.
But was December 25th his birthday? Some folks say that the loudest theory is that no, his birthday was not the 25th, but rather the Roman Catholic Church decided to make December 25th the celebration of Christmas in order to push back against a pagan holiday celebrating winter solstice. But there is some other interesting studies, one by the Andrew McGowan at the Yale Divinity School, who has actually found that there was a lot of interest in the early 3rd and 4th century in trying to figure out when Jesus's birth was mm-hmm. prior to the Roman conversion to Christianity,
right.
That says that maybe it's actually not a response to so-called pagan holidays. Maybe there really was a real interest in when he was born. And one of the theories that potentially caused December 25th to be the date is that there was a history, and I'll just give you the Reader's Digest version here. There's a history that says that maybe Christ's conception was on March 25th, which 9 months later would be December 25th. And that's one reason why some folks in the 4th century may have thought that December 25th was the date and began celebrating it.
Oh.
Now, of course, we then have centuries and centuries of kind of going back and forth on how we celebrate Christmas.
Right.
When we get to the early Americas, for mm-hmm. instance, we have Christmas that had become, truth be told, a bit of a drunkardly affair. So
a bit merry.
A bit merry.
A bit merry.
And so we had some Puritans then who really pushed back against it and said, we are not going to celebrate this thing you call Christmas. You will get in trouble if you don't show up to work on Christmas Day. You will mm-hmm. get in trouble if you don't show up to school because it is almost sacrilegious to celebrate the birth of Christ, or at least to observe the birth of Christ
right.
with drunkenness. But then, you know, fast forward a few more years, and after the Civil War, we've had a bit of a change of pace in American culture, and there's a bit of maybe a Victorian revival that brings Christmas a little bit closer to what we know today.
Right. Well, what I thought was kind of interesting when I started, the question I always had about Christmas, talking about it being in December and being cold, and you started off by talking about how where you grew up and it was wonderful and it was snowy.
It's true.
Well,
it's
I grew
true.
Up in North Carolina
mm.
where we did not have a snowy Christmas. The closest we could get would possibly an ice storm, and nobody wants that. So I got kind of curious about where does this idea of the snowy Christmas come from? I mean, there's definitely, you know, there are a lot of things, but when we see Jesus being born, we don't see him in, you know, drifts of snow.
That's true. Bethlehem is not the most snowy locale on the globe.
Right. Mm. Not a lot of ski gear being sold over there. So I got kind of curious about this. And what I discovered was that the reason that we have our idealization of a white Christmas comes because a volcano exploded on April 5th, 1815.
A volcano. You're going to have to fill the gaps for just a little bit here.
Okay, so April 5th, 1815.
Though my mind is now racing as to how a volcano caused us to have a white Christmas. Fill in the gaps for
this
us.
This is why you go to a liberal arts institution.
Yes. You've piqued my curiosity.
Okay. So there is a volcano named Mount Tambora, which is in Indonesia. And on April 5th, 1815, 200 years ago, it exploded. And it exploded so loudly that over 800 miles away, somebody heard it and thought it was a cannon.
Wow.
Yeah, that's how loud it was. 5 days later, it exploded so dramatically that it was the biggest volcanic explosion in 2,000 years.
Hmm.
Now, I don't know how they know these things, but I didn't go to geology school. So the explosion was so significant that it sent sulfates and, I don't know, stuff. I think I mentioned I did not go to geology school.
Mm-hmm. Stuff is a scientific term.
It is a very scientific term. Mm-hmm. Sent it 27 miles in the air.
Wow.
And as a result of all of this sulfates and stuff, it sent it all into the atmosphere and had the effect of essentially blocking out the sun.
Wow.
I mean, I'm sure there was something milky and glowy up there, but the year 1816, the next year, is called the Year Without a Summer.
Hmm.
And this was the year, 1816 was the year that Frankenstein was written, as they were all sort of huddled up in their house, and it was June, and it was freezing, and they're having these discussions, and so Frankenstein...
No wonder they had so many pitchforks, there's torches on hand to go with their pitchforks.
Well, actually, you might be joking, but they said that as she was on her way, Mary Shelley looked down, and she included all these things that she saw as she was on her way to this house, of all of the pitchforks and the lights.
Fiery torches,
because it was cold and it was dark and it was freezing and it was June.
Hmm.
And that was also when they wrote stories about vampires, but vampires with a Y because these are classy vampires.
Hmm.
So, and this is important because in 1812, 4 years before the Year Without a Summer, Charles Dickens was born.
Okay.
Yeah, here we go. Okay, so Charles Dickens was born in 1812. The 1810s, because of the explosion of this volcano, was the coldest decade in Britain in over 100 years. It was really cold. So the six of the first nine Christmases, Charles Dickens' Christmases, were white Christmases.
Oh.
Six of the first nine. Now, on the other hand, I was looking up some stuff today, and apparently... London now has between a 6% and 8% chance of ever having a white Christmas. So 6 out of 9 back then was pretty interesting.
Yes.
Charles Dickens had grown to idealize Christmas. He idealized his childhood. He idealized all of this, you know, the white Christmas and the family and all this kind of stuff. And he idealized his childhood, which ended promptly at the age of 12 when his father was thrown into debtor's prison. And Charles Dickens had to go get a work in a bootblack factory, putting labels on cans, which is probably not the worst job in the factory, but still, you know, he's still 12 working in a bootblack factory. So as he got older, he was writing these Christmas stories. And what's interesting about this is that Charles Dickens not only presented to us this idealized version of a white Christmas, he also revitalized Christmas itself by writing the Christmas Carol and some other stories. At that point, the middle class had sort of seen Christmas as becoming sort of antiquated, and kind of, you know, it had been sort of reserved to sort of the way America treats Easter right now. You might get a day off, but not really. And he also, because that was the period in time when Prince Albert brought in Christmas trees.
Oh.
And so he wrote an essay about Christmas trees and helped to foster the popularity of Christmas trees. So a lot of the stuff the fact that we even celebrate Christmas in this sort of grand secular way that we do really kind of dates back to a lot of what Charles Dickens did.
We really do celebrate a Dickensian Christmas.
It is a Dickensian Christmas.
Wow.
Yeah.
All right, number 10.
All right. So what is a manger, and why do we show the baby Jesus in one in Christmas displays?
This is the part of Christmas that is a little less Dickensian.
less Dickensian, somewhat.
So a manger is the actual crib that we would show Jesus in the typical depictions of the nativity of the birth of Christ. The manger is just the it's kind of the little... place where you put the hay and the straw for the food for the animals to eat. Mm-hmm. Manger actually comes from the old French, and my old French. I'm going to butcher the old French. So all you old French linguists
out
there.
What was your old
French in college? mangeoire, perhaps? Mangeoire, old French mangeoire, which means crib that you eat from. And so we have this crib from manger, to eat, and that leads to our manger, which is where the donkeys ate out
right.
of. This is, we see the nativity displays now that are technically called a creche, which is from the old French, which I can pronounce creche.
Ooh, that's good.
And that also means the crib or stall that mm-hmm. Animals would eat out of. And the reason we depict the baby Jesus in that crib is because that is quite directly the way that it is recorded in the Gospel of Luke. In Luke chapter 2, verses 12, the angel tells the shepherds out there, "Now this will be a sign to you. You will find a babe wrapped in clothes lying in a manger." And suddenly the great company of the heavenly host appeared with the angel, praising God and saying, "Glory to God in the highest. Heaven and on earth peace to those to whom his favor rests." And so the reason we have Jesus in the little manger bed is because that's the way the gospel records it.
All right. Okay. So the next question, speaking of the creche or the nativity scene, is it legal for government buildings like a city hall or a courthouse to put up a nativity display?
That is an interesting question, and the answer is not a simple one. The answer is maybe. It is maybe legal for it to be displayed in a government building. The Supreme Court has actually ruled a few different times on religious displays, both in terms of, say, the Ten Commandments being shown in a courthouse, and explicitly they've had cases about nativity displays in government buildings, mm-hmm. and they have ruled both ways in divergent cases. So in some contexts they say, yes, it is okay for the Ten Commandments to be in your courthouse. Sometimes they say no. They have ruled, for instance, in a case in the 1980s, Lynch v. Donnelly, it was a 1984 case, they said that, yes, that government display of a nativity, that is legal. It is constitutional to do so. Just a couple years later, in the County of Allegheny versus the ACLU, they determined that, nope, that nativity display is...
Not so much
constitutional. And the real question there is it a unique endorsement of religion?
Oh,
is there
okay.
something about the display that tends to favor the Christian portion of the holiday over other groups? Would the reasonable observer determine that this is this special treatment
right.
by the government? The court has ruled, though, that it is perfectly constitutional for a government building to recognize the religious history of the holiday. They've been doing this for years. They paid chaplains.
Right.
Christmas was made a federal holiday in the 19th century, and so to show Christmas as having religious heritage is perfectly constitutional. And quite frankly, I think the court would be reasonable in saying, it would be crazy for us to try to pretend that there's not a religious heritage to Christmas.
We just arbitrarily give you the December 25th off.
Right, yeah. Yes, right. We're right. still celebrating winter solstice. though at the same time, though, the court also is very strongly in favor of making sure that that celebrating Christmas does not come at the detriment to other religious traditions
right.
either, because coming at the detriment to another would be really just a kind of backhanded way of giving an endorsement to another religion.
Right.
So the celebrations of Hanukkah or Kwanzaa or the secular human light celebrations, those all happen around the same time of year as Christmas, and the federal government, the courts have found it to be important to make sure that those are given their fair space as well.
Happy holidays.
Happy holidays
right.
indeed. Which actually brings us to our final question. We have covered a rather wide array of topics, from questions 1 through 11, from corporate business practices to religious histories, but let's bring it back home a little bit here for our last question. So question number 12, marketing professor Amanda Bauer, for you, what is Christmas? How does it kind of reach in and stay meaningful for you year after year?
Well, so it comes as no shock that I was knowing this question was coming. And so I've thought about it quite a bit. And I tried to think about it in a way that was unique to us or to our family. And I can come up with a little bit, but not much. But, the year is busy and kids are busy and husband is busy and my family's busy. And, we're everywhere and we come together. And I was thinking about something that's particularly meaningful to me at Christmas. And I was thinking about how back in 1984, the George C. Scott version of A Christmas Carol. I know I sound like a Dickens addict. I'm totally fine with that. But
you're the Dickens addict. I'm the Charlie Brown addict.
Charlie Brown addict.
We've got Christmas covered.
Yeah. Yes, we have all we need is like an It's in a Wonderful Life person, and then we've got like the Trinity covered. But so my dad and I watched this, the George C. Scott version of A Christmas Carol, and we recorded it one year on these things kids called a VCR. And we recorded it, and we watched the videotape of it year after year, and we always watch it on Christmas Eve. And then when the VCR wore out, we got the DVD. And when the DVD wore out, we watched it every year on, we now watch it on streaming.
Oh.
And we watch it every year. And my dad and I watch it. And now my daughter watches it with me. My son acts like he's watching it and, you know, has his nose in an iPad, but we pretend. And it's nice because we're all together. Hmm. And every year when it's over, my dad stands up and he says, "We can have Christmas now." And I grew up, my dad was a surgeon, and he was always busy and gone and having to put people back together. People don't take the best care of themselves at Christmas time. And it just meant a lot to me to have that one time with my family right before Christmas starts.
Yeah, that's wonderful.
And what about you?
Well, for me, I mean, I do love all things Christmas. I love going to little plug for Bronner's. I do love going to Bronner's. I love the lights. I love the sounds. I love the Christmas music. I love the Christmas specials. At its heart, though, I kind of see Christmas the way Linus sees Christmas for me personally, that it is the birth of Christ is meaningful to me. My faith has been meaningful to me from a very early age, and it still is. I also find the history of Christmas to be quite fascinating as well. And so I really enjoy the season on a number of levels. In Luke chapter 2, after the angel has announced to the shepherds that Christ was born, and after they have proclaimed glory to God in the highest, St. Luke records, "And when the angels had left them and gone into heaven, the shepherds said to one another, 'Let's go to Bethlehem and see this thing that has happened, which the Lord has told us about.'" And that being able to go and remember this thing that has happened every season is, for me, really, really quite meaningful each year. And with that, our 12 questions of Christmas are complete. We actually made it through all 12. Good for us.
Oh, my goodness, I know.
And so I guess those of you out there in listening land, we will let you return to your hot cocoa. Thank you so much, Amanda Bauer, for being here with me. This has been quite fun.
Thank you for having me.
Oh, absolutely. I am Stephen Land. I've been here with Amanda Bauer. You can find Amanda on social media at HeyProfBau, and you can find out more about my new book, A Charlie Brown Religion, at acharliebrownreligion.com. We would like to thank our special guests, of course, Professor Megan Fulcher and Bronner's Christmas Wonderland CEO Wayne Bronner, along with the fine folks at the Washington and Lee University Station and our wonderful broadcast host, NPR station WMRA, for making this program possible. From all of us here to all of you listeners out there, season's greetings, season's farewells, happy holidays, and have a very Merry Christmas.